Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to WBAI New York Radio 99.5 FM. Welcome to Black Star News Show. I'm your host, Milton Alamadi. And today we're going to be looking at the coup d'etat last Sunday in Guinea in West Africa, where 83-year-old President Alpha Conde was overthrown by a special force within the military led by Mamadi Doumbouya. And to help us walk through this is Guinea-born Nasser Diallo. And he has a very interesting story, and hopefully we'll get into that in a bit. But let me first provide his resume. He is a digital media specialist with over 10 years experience in developing innovative programs that facilitate the digitization of citizens, businesses, and governments in the U.S., U.K., France, Africa south of the Sahara. He's worked as a public analyst at Facebook, where he designed, delivered, and monitored programs that support digital literacy and stimulate growth in Francophone Africa and Europe. He's now CEO of Clinic Plus O, a technology-enabling network of medical providers and partners that offer primary care services for marginalized communities in West Africa. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Nasser Diallo.
Thank you, Brother Milton. So nice to be here, and thanks for having me.
Excellent. So you have an interesting story. We first met several years ago here in New York, when you had actually fled from Guinea following another coup d'etat. I want you to get into that eventually, but you're doing very interesting work now because obviously digital technology is making tremendous impact in terms of innovation in Africa. So before we get into Guinea, I want you to talk about some of the work you've been doing and some of the impact it's had. But begin by telling us why you chose that particular medium. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So digital technology, because I am a former political journalist, as you pointed out, I used to be based in Guinea and I fled Guinea in 2010 after a military coup that had left some scares on our country, on our people, and particularly on me. And then I saw an opportunity in terms of new technology, digital technology. And I understood that it is an affordance. You can make of it whatever it is that you want. You can use it to spread false news and misinformation and call for violence, right? But also you can use it to do great things such as empowering people to access primary care services, empowering people to access financial services, bridging geographical distant locations. So I have chosen to do the latter. So education has been a path that I wanted to achieve here. So I went to school here in the US, graduated from GW, and then after that went to Oxford to study public policy with concentration on digital technology and got a job at Facebook. So part of my work at Facebook was empowering communities to understand the power of digital technology, but also use digital technology to unlock opportunities. So, for example, we provided how to use WhatsApp, how to use Facebook to communicate, but also to share services, to share news, to empower citizens to be proactively engaged within the development of their countries and their continent for the past 2 years. And then I resigned from Facebook, founded an organization called Clinic O, that offer primary care services to marginalized communities. To date, 6 months from the time I started clinical, we have provided 2,500 consultations to people who live with less than $1 a day, and 85% of these consultations were resolved over the phone. No further actions were needed. So these people are getting back their health. They are primarily farmers, and then they can go back to farming and lift themselves out of poverty.
So give us an example. How would it start? Would the farmer go on his or her phone and access? How this connection done? I just want to visualize how it's done. It sounds very interesting.
Fantastic. So we are using digital technology in collaboration with community healthcare workers. So just to give you a background, so we have 0.8 physicians per 1,000 people in Guinea and 0.4 nurses per 1,000 people in Guinea. So physicians and nurses are a scarce resource in Guinea. So we are working with community healthcare workers. A community healthcare worker is anyone who has a junior high school degree with 6 months of healthcare training. So what we do, we provide them with smartphones and internet connections. And the good news is we are following the path of mobile network operators who are trying to connect rural West Africa for mobile money resources. I think mobile network operators such as Orange, MTN, and Safaricom understood that, or Vodafone understood that marginalized communities are not as poor as they thought, right? They are unbanked, and there is a huge potential type. So for that reason, they are going to provide connectivity in rural West Africa for that matter. And we are following their steps. Wherever they provide connectivity, we identify a local community healthcare worker, we train them, we provide them medical equipment, and we ask them to proactively search for people who are looking for primary care services. And then once a community healthcare worker finds someone who needs primary care services, they use WhatsApp to dial and speak to a physician who is in Conakry, in the capital of Guinea, to provide primary care services. And the physician will instruct the community healthcare worker to do follow-up. And we use Google Docs and Google Drives to write a report. And also we have a collaboration. We are collaborating with the government in which they are accepting now digital prescriptions. So people are no longer required to travel 500, 1,000 miles just to access primary care services for 1 hour or 2 hours in the capital. So that's how we are doing it now.
This is amazing. So the potential sounds limitless. Are you trying to upscale this to regionally in West Africa and then even wider on the continent?
That is correct, Milton. So I resigned from Facebook a month ago to focus solely on clinical. This is to tell you how serious I am about this. There are 8 million people in Guinea who do not have access to primary care services. I'm starting with them in the next 3 years. I am going to work to cover those 8 million people by partnering with government. So for those who are in America, if you want to understand how our platform will look like, it will look like the Medicaid platform in which the government can digitally subsidize healthcare by providing resources to those families who live with less than $1 a day. At this point, the government is very much willing, or at least the former government was very much willing to subsidize healthcare, but the only way to do so was through cash. And cash is a big no because there is a huge corruption scheme that is attached to it. So we are developing a platform in which we can positively identify people who live below the poverty line and then have government chime in and then bring in the private sector and then after that, bring in philanthropy. The idea is to create sustainability. Now, once we have that, because no philanthropy can take you out of poverty, as you may know, we want to lean on that to go in rural West Africa, where we have 100 million people who do not have access to primary care services. And why we are optimistic about rural West Africa, it's because we have been divided by artificial borders, meaning almost the same realities in rural Senegal is similar to rural Guinea, similar to rural Burkina Faso. So we are confident if we are able to pilot this project and scale it up in Guinea to 8 million people, we can replicate that and adapt it to other countries in West Africa to cover the 100 million people in the next 10 years.
Oh, this is remarkable. You sound very enthusiastic about this program as well. Tell us why.
I am extremely hopeful and enthusiastic because I am, as I pointed out, I am coming from Facebook. I have seen what technology can do for people for fun. Like people are highly connected on Facebook and they are not receiving primary care services on Facebook, but they are there. So we thought, like, if 10 years ago, I have to buy a calling card to speak to my mom, which cost me about $100 a month. Today, I just need to use the free Wi-Fi that I have home because I'm paying Wi-Fi anyway to speak to my mom endlessly without paying any dime. I think we can transfer that into the healthcare system. That's one. Two, healthcare is the basis of human flourishing, right? So I am from rural Guinea. My family was the bottom of the pyramid. I can tell you how my father, who suffered from diabetes, affected our family. So yeah. I think my father used to travel about 700 miles round trip just was to see a doctor in 15 minutes and for that doctor to tell him that his glucose, meaning his sugar level, is high or low. Today, right. We are doing it in 5 minutes with a community healthcare worker beyond my father's little town, right? So you can see my enthusiasm or you can feel my enthusiasm because I think if a parent is able to provide for their child and keep them in school and encourage them to break out the poverty circle, I think it will be phenomenal for our countries and our continent because no amount of aid, no amount of foreign donation can substitute what we can do for ourselves, right? So we are in the business of providing primary care services, but the end goal is to empowering people to lift themselves out of poverty and live within dignity in our countries and in our continent. And there is no compromise on that. We have found a model that is very sustainable. We are not beggars. We have a business model, and our business model is following the steps of Western organizations such as Orange, such as MTN, mobile network operators who found a way to make money with people who are least well off. So we are following their steps to say, instead of just making money, let's ensure we are also taking care of these people. And I am extremely, extremely grateful for this opportunity. And I have not thought twice to resign from Facebook and go back home and do this.
Okay, so one final question on this issue before we move on to the coup d'etat in Guinea. In terms of starting, because I think what you're talking about should also inspire other young Africans who perhaps may have a vision of wanting to do something with significant impact on the continent without having to rely on governments. Governments typically have been obstacles to progress in most African countries. So in terms of formulating and launching, did you draw up a business plan and then did you approach potential seed funders? How did you really get started?
I use 60% of my resources. I believe in practicing what I preach. Instead of asking for someone to help me do something, I wanted to show people what I'm doing. So I use 60% of my resources to start clinical, and it worked, and it was really easy to bring in people. So we are a social impact venture. So we have people who are providing us some grants, people who are providing us some donations, but also people who are interested in investing because we have a viable business model that will enable us to be sustainable and potentially provide return to those who are investing. I think in a certain context, government can be an obstacle, but in terms of healthcare, we have to find a way to make them our allies because healthcare is the business of government, right? No private company can develop healthcare. So the government has been extremely helpful in partnering with us. So a good example is once they saw our curriculum, our digitally enabled curriculum, they asked us to use that as the national curriculum for community health workers everywhere in Guinea. That's one. Two, they also asked us to create a platform that will enable them to supervise the work of community healthcare workers, but also properly pay them. So government, we have to find ways in which to collaborate with them, to build allyship with them because I think we have a common goal. The goal is to better the lives of citizens.
I agree with you. And I might add that considering the billions of dollars that African governments spend on military hardware, there's no reason why they should not divert much of the spending to healthcare services. So thank you for that wonderful update on what you've been doing lately. Listeners, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBI 99.5 FM radio. Our guest is Nassar Diallo, Guinea-born, and now a digital entrepreneur. And we're going to be discussing the coup d'etat on Sunday in Guinea. But listeners, this is the point where I remind you that WBAI is 100% listener supported. We take no commercials, and that is how we can bring you these type of programs. And a good example is today's discussion. So at this point, I do remind you to pick up the phone and dial 212-219-2950. And any support you give to WBAI will be put to supporting shows such as this. You can also support us by adopting our shows as a buddy. And obviously, I hope Black Star News Show is one of those shows you adopt as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out on a monthly basis from your debit or credit card. And you can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBI.org. Now back to our discussion with our guest today, Nassar Diallo. So, Nassar, the coup d'etat in Guinea. This is not the first time there's been a coup in Guinea, and you can tell us how many coups there have been. But more interestingly, there's been media coverage that the fact that this special force or unit that was being trained by the United States is the unit that became involved in this coup d'etat. There are photographs or videos, rather, that have gone viral showing Guinean soldiers driving in the city in a convoy and being cheered by civilians. But in some of those vehicles, American soldiers was also shown waving or shaking hands with the civilians who are celebrating the demise of this president who was 83 years old. And now, of course, there's speculation in terms of the role that the United States might have been involved in this coup d'etat. But regardless of that role, whether they were directly, indirectly, or even not involved, tell us generally about this particular coup d'etat. What is unique about it compared to any other of the previous coups, including the one that you managed to get away from with your very life, which was at risk at that time? The floor is yours.
Thank you so much. So this Guinea has had so far three military coups, including this one. But the first two military coups, if I may just provide some context, are a bit different than this one because they were military coups in which we had our former president pass away. So the first one was in 1984 when our founding father, former President Ahmed Sekou Touré, died. And then the next line in succession was for the president of the parliament or the National Assembly to take power. So we are calling that a military coup because the army refused that and took power. But right. They have not... the president died, and that's why they took power. And the second case was...
And remind listeners, how long had he been in power? I know he'd been there for a very long time.
Yes, he has been in power for 24 years, from 1958 to 1984, so 24 years in power, and he died in power. And our second president was the person who did the coup, Lansana Conte. Then he was colonel, and then he died as a general in 2008 after 25 years in power. And then the same scenario happens. The head of the parliament was supposed to take power, and then a captain of the army took power and dissolved the constitution and everything. His name is Dadis Camara, and then things get out of control, and unfortunately, he did not have the wisdom, I shall say, to organize an election, and Levy wanted to be part of that election because there were a lot of noise, a lot of opportunistic people who were telling him to stay because if he stays, they stay. And right. he ended up being shot in the head, and now he lives in exile in Burkina Faso. That was the second military coup that we have in Guinea.
All right. So talk then about the speculation about the U.S. Role, or was that incidental?
At this point, I don't have enough substance to say whether it is a U.S. involvement or if it's just someone else. I think the U.S. embassy in Conakry has denied any involvement of any official involvement of the United States. I've seen the video that you have pointed out. It's very hard to link the U.S. to the military coup. A lot of witnesses have mentioned that no foreign person was involved in arresting the president. And in entering the presidential palace, it's very different than what happened in Ivory Coast when the French troops were involved in arresting President Laurent Gbagbo. They were in at the door of the presidential palace. All the witnesses said this was carried on by the special forces. Now, I'm not sure whether by seeing the special forces with U.S. troops or people who pose as U.S. troops means that they are involved or not. I'm not sure what to make of that because I don't have any official source that can back up what I'm saying.
Okay, so now let's talk. First of all, we'll get into the internal dynamics, but let's talk in a general sense about what is essentially a neocolonial arrangement. And we're not just talking about Guinea alone, because this is general throughout Africa in terms of relations between former colonial powers and the African countries. So, for example, in Chad, you know, we had the coup in April after the death of Idriss Deby when his son Mohamed was installed. In fact, the French president actually flew there to N'Djamena for the installation of the son. And then in Mali, where we had the coup in May by the same person, Colonel Assimi Goïta, who also pulled out the same coup in the same country last year in August. And in both those countries, there's a very strong French, essentially, control. What is the situation in Guinea? Because now with the U.S. involved in training parts of the military, is this sort of a competition between the United States and France in terms of trying to gain influence in Guinea?
I think it's poor leadership in the first place. What I mean by poor leadership, it's the ability of our leaders to have a clear vision of what they want and what they don't want, and the inability for our leaders to draw boundaries on where a former colonizer or any bilateral or multilateral organization can step in. So it is a common practice to have our troops being trained in Israel or in China or in whomever comes first, because we are that country and to a certain extent that continent where, you know, we feel disabled, right? As if we cannot do our own trainings or we cannot. It's just sickening, Milton, to see that everything has to come from outside. And we have no responsibility, whether it is financial responsibility, military responsibility, or social responsibility. That's the first thing. So
I agree with that.
With that said, we have Guinea is a mess in the sense that anyone that comes with an idea of providing free things can be taken without being vetted, without knowing what is their agenda. There is no such thing like free lunch. When someone train your army, they will sell you a weapon. It's just right. you don't need to go to school to understand that. When someone invests in you, so we have right now China, the US, and Europe, a financial presence and strategic presence in our countries because we have not set any boundaries. You cannot come into the United States and just wake up and say, I'm going to train the Marines. That's not going to happen. Right. So I think we opened up our country. And I think now the president understood that he does not even know where that idea came or where that mentality of toppling him down came, because the guy was trained, the special forces were trained in Israel, in France, in America, in China. Like it's just too much. Now we are a former colonized country, Brother Milton, unfortunately. And the former colonizer has a grip on us. How? Through the language. I'm not French. I'm speaking French. I speak French. That's our, we call ourselves French. Why? Because like 65% of the Guinean population does not know how to read and write. And we yet call ourselves French. That's how we identify ourselves, French. And 65% of our population do not know how to speak French, right? So we were unable to take our destiny in our own hands because of the successions of military coups, poor leaderships, and now we had an intellectual president, or at least we thought who was intellectual president, who deemed himself to be the Nelson Mandela of Guinea, unfortunately being humiliated in the face of the world, and very difficult to pinpoint who has influenced this this military coup, and it works for the West. They don't want to be identified. They don't want you to know who is behind this, because it's just so much people and so many hands involved that it works for them. We have the second largest reserve of bauxite. You think the West is going to leave us? No, bauxite is used to build aluminium. Aluminium is used to build cars, airplanes, and everything. So they are there to stay. Now, if we don't have leaders who understand that, who understand it's not just about military, it's about a vision, a self-sustaining vision that will help ourselves, help our country and ourselves, then we'll be still in that situation, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, talk a little bit about the minerals you mentioned, bauxite, and of course you have diamonds as well. You have gold.
We do.
Talk about the competition over the resources. First of all, amongst the domestic elite and then the outside forces as well.
So Guinea is perceived as a piece of cake in which we have a smaller portion that can be given to the elites, okay, and the bigger portion that will be given to the rest of the world. What I mean by that, it's Europe, some European companies, some American companies, Chinese and Russian companies. They are all there. And what is unfortunate, we are exporting the raw natural resource that worth nothing.
Right.
We do not even have the intelligence of creating factories that will enable us to transform our natural resources into something that is more valuable, and therefore creating jobs for our communities, therefore creating a knowledge and know-how sharing. So it's just taking dirt, bauxite is dirt, and putting it in containers and then shipping it into China, in Russia, in America, and then they send us an aluminum plate that costs 20 times more than the dirt. We buy the plate, we put our rice over there, and we eat like idiots. That's how it is. And our elite is...
And by the way, that's not only for Guinea. That's for every African country, regardless of what resource they have. But go ahead. I agree with you 100%.
And now the elite is benefiting from it because, you know, $100-200 million is nothing for a government, but it's a heck of something for one person, right? So they are taking this money and putting it into their account or into their pockets, and there is no responsibility, there is no accountability, right? How can you tell me a country like Guinea, who has the second or the first largest reserve of bauxite in the world, and that is exploiting it 24/7, that does not have a public hospital? Our public hospital, people go there when they are in the process or when they know they are dying. If they are not dying, they rather not go there. Why? Because if you go to our hospitals with a low human system, you are very likely to come back with something that you have not had before going to the hospital, unfortunately, right? So we have a very corrupt elite, okay? People who have been there, who have been recycled over and over. Now, I'm not exaggerating. the same people who are alive, who worked with our former president, Lansana Conte, who died in 2008, as long as they are alive, they are, most of them are part of the government of president, former president Alpha Conde. And they are still there. And if a next government comes, they would just, they are still there. Like, the only thing that can remove them from there, it's death. And we do not invest in the new generations, right? And someone like me in Guinea is perceived as a threat. I was educated outside of Guinea, never held a public office. I'm not interested in holding in holding one in this current context, right? But I'm perceived as a threat because I want to do something for my country. I want to do something for my community. The mentalities have to change, and we have to have a hard stop. So the international community, Milton, is condemning the military coup. Where were they when we were when Alpha Condé were changing the constitution? Where were they?
It's all crocodile tears. I agree with you. Our listeners, we are taking a short break, and we'll be back with the second half hour of Black Star News Show. Greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome back to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio, also streaming on WBAI.org. I am your host, Milton Alimadi. Our guest is Nassar Diallo, a digital technology expert, Guinea-born. And we're having the conversation about the coup d'etat in Guinea. And we ended up halfway point. We've been talking about the mineral resources and the paradox, not only for Guinea, by the way, all these African countries with immense mineral wealth, selling it as raw commodities to the industrialized world and then importing manufactured products that cost 20 or 100 times more. That is indeed the crisis, not only for Guinea, but also for the rest of the continent. Now, Nassar, you had started hinting toward possible solutions. So what are the solutions? I mean, personally, when I see these coups in African countries, I refer to them as useless coups. You have the military elite competing with the political elite. They're not the type of takeovers that we saw in what was Upper Volta in 1983 when Thomas Sankara came to power and changed the name of the country to Burkina Faso and change everything else, really. Connected government with the population, mobilized domestic resources to produce, started building clinics throughout the country, building schools, building trees to stop desertification, when in fact many countries in the West were not yet even talking about issues of the environment. And then, of course, empowered women, gave them meaningful roles in government, recruited them into the armed forces, and of course inspired so many people, not only in Burkina Faso, but throughout the African continent. And of course, Sankara ultimately touched the third rail when at the OAU meeting, the Organization of African Unity, and that is the organization that preceded the African Union. At the meeting in Addis Ababa in 1987, he called on all African countries to come together to renounce the foreign debt that was holding back economic growth in Africa. And he said, if I do it alone, I will not be alive to attend next year's conference, but they cannot assassinate all of us. And sure enough, within 3 months, he was dead, October 1987, killed by Blaise Compaoré, his so-called second in command, with very much suspected French influence. So that, to me, was a different kind of coup d'etat. I would not mind seeing more Thomas Sankaras throughout Africa. I don't know how your own assessment is.
You are absolutely right. I think Thomas Sankara has been an inspiration for the for Francophone Africa and for Africa period, right? What he has done and his vision was really, really breathtaking. But I think also the former colonizers sent a very clear message. We do not want to see more Thomas Sankaras in your countries. If not, you will end the way he ends. And I think that deterrence, that really deterred people who take who take power to behave the way he behaved, because we are still under the grip of the former colonizer, right? So an example, if the first thing that Mamadi Doumbouya said in Guinea, oh, we are not changing your contract, your mining contract, we are not stopping the mine, because he knows if he does not say something like that, there might be some consequences.
It would not last long, right?
Exactly. That's what I meant by consequences, right? So I think Sankara is one of the few leaders who was willing to use his life to set a tone, to set an example. Not a lot of people are willing to do that. It's very hard to ask someone to do that. That has to come within, not without. I do agree with you with the political elite competing with the military elite. In Guinea, it has been the case so far. And no solution can come out of such a scenario. You know why? Because the military elite is so limited, and the pressure of the international community is so intense that they have to govern with the political elite. Whether we are talking about transition, or you are talking about a successful military coup in which you have elected a former military president who left the military uniform. In Guinea, for example, we are going to organize a transition, but there will be civilian in the government, right? Now, right. Whenever there is a civilian in the government that is led by military, that civilian is led by fear. Fear, because you know that these people do not have the mandate of their citizen, right. And they don't listen to their citizens. And if their interests are, and they are not accountable to the citizens, they use weapons to take power. And they are terrorizing everyone with their weapons, right? It's called a state of exception, like in French we call it an état d'exception, a state of exception, right? So that fear is not good for a transition that is deemed to lay out the design of democracy. Let me elaborate. So through that fear, you can choose the wrong candidate, or you can think about having a deal with this candidate who will hand you power. There are so many scenarios that can be worked out, right? Let's say if you prevail the financial hurdle, which I think he will prevail because he has not jeopardized any international interest from anyone in Guinea that is involved in exploiting Guinean resources. Now, what is the solution? I think the solution is understanding, as you rightfully pointed out with Thomas Sankara, that life is short and you will be judged based on not how much money you have had, but how much impact you have had on your country. And this is your moment, Commandant Doumbouya. This is your moment to make the right decision. What I mean by the right decision is first to refuse to recycle every person who have contributed to creating the atmosphere or the unlawful third term that led President Condé to put our country into this situation. I cannot comprehend that someone is irrepressible. I cannot comprehend that. If these people are irrepressible, then we are dead. You know why? Because they have done nothing for our country. And if they are irrepressible, meaning that the people that we have are less skilled and less and have less vision than them, then they won't be Guinea in the next few years. I think they are irrepressible, and you have to find people. It's very hard to judge people's integrity based on the conversation that you have, but just give a chance to someone else and see what they are capable of doing. Second, don't make this transition an opportunity for you to come back in power. Make this transition an opportunity for Guinea to be a democratic country, because if Guinea is a democratic country, if you live in that country, you are able to create your own political party and come back and compete. but don't make this a deal. If you make this a deal, you will be giving the power not to the right person, but to the person who will be likely willing to give it back to you. And finally, do not use your position to empty our safe, knowing that you have limited time there and you have to serve yourself, serve your community, serve your colleagues as it used to be. Just understand that you are a watchdog. You are the man of the moment. But 10 years ago, Captain Dadis Camara was the man of the moment, right? And no one remember him today because right. he has not done the right thing or have not made the right decision that people could remember him as Sankara. And finally, if it is the way that your life will end, I think you are prepared to it, because to do a military coup, you have to put your life in line. So go all the way to the end. Don't just do 50% of the job.
Understood. Now, in terms of the role that the military can also play in taking the country in a different and more progressive direction, we can also look to Ghana, which of course was led by a Pan-African revolutionary at the time of independence, Kwame Nkrumah, independence in 1957 from Britain. He was all about continental unity, a United States of Africa, as the only way that we would be strong enough to protect our resources from the powerful industrialized countries that still wanted Africa's resources. And of course, he was ultimately overthrown in 1966 in a United States-involved coup. And this is even much more clear now when you go into the archives of the State Department and you see all those documents, communication exchange between the U.S. Embassy in Accra and the State Department and even the White House. But then Ghana went through a series of coups after Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown, until Jerry Rawlings came to power. And Jerry Rawlings, of course, regardless of what one might feel about him, he helped laid a foundation of stability in Ghana. And Ghana is now admired by many people for the several successive peaceful transfer of power. In fact, in cases where even opposition parties have won, the incumbent has agreed and stepped down. So that is another example of a military intervention, which could be regarded as positive. And, well, you've expressed some of your concerns about the situation in Guinea right now with Mamadi Doumbouya. Do you have any knowledge about his background, enough knowledge to assess as to whether you think he could lead Guinea in a progressive, positive direction?
I think he has a solid military training, and his military training proved to be efficient, because the way the military coup was carried out was extremely, extremely well done. So it shows that he's someone who has leadership skills, who has vision, but also who has the ability to execute his ideas. Second, he says enough on the media. He's the opposite of President Dadis Camara, who could speak hours and hours and hours. He would just say what is essential and move on. And he created a charter for the transition that lays out the conditions. Now, is he going to be able to lead Guinea? That's a huge question mark, because leadership is not just one person. It's a consortium of people. And the chance of Ghana was the timing. I think the timing was right. And the action taken by former President Jerry Rawlings were right. Meaning, using his own family as an example to deter people from thinking that he's here to play. I think he condemned or executed his own nephew, who were proven to be guilty of corruption in Ghana. I think if we have to do that in Guinea, I think we will condemn and execute all the members of the outgoing government. I'm not advocating or suggesting for that. What I think it's trying to organize a commission in which he can assess the leadership of the former government officials and show them that there should be and there must be a level of accountability. I think if you are elected or appointed to serve the public, you have to be accountable to them. If not, things will get worse and worse. So creating that, figuring out who holds what and how and why, and then clearing that those who are supposed to be free will be free, those who are supposed to pay will pay, and the country will lean on that to move on. A strong justice a system that is not partisan, but that will be based on facts. Second, I will not advocate for him to stay on power and do what Rawlings has done in Ghana. Why? Because the risk is greater than the possibility. It's like 90% risk that it will not work than 90% risk that it will work. So if he stays in power and things do not go toward the right direction, what is our backup?
It's probably another coup.
Exactly. And then we will be in a succession of military coups. There is nothing horrible than when military attacks military.
Right.
It's just a tragedy, right? So I think his position and his action should stop at organizing an election and being a watchdog and not allowing any president to send him to another country because they deem that he is a threat. Making that part of it, but also not posing as a threat to any government that is doing the right work that they are supposed to do. I think we have to have the military there as a watchdog in our young countries and let civilians do the work, but have for them to have that in the back of their mind, you are on an ejectable siege if in case, you know, you think that you can lead without accountability. But the model of Rawlings might take us. We have already had our own Rawlings, General Lansana Conte, who was a military guy and who failed the country, to be honest. And I don't think we would like to have something like that because it went toward the wrong direction rather.
Understood. Okay, so listeners, we're now coming toward the conclusion of today's program. So I want to take this opportunity one more time to remind you that we are entirely 100% listener supported. We don't take commercials, and that is why we can bring you the type of discussion you're listening to today. So this time, I do remind you once again, pick up the phone and dial 212-219-2950 and show some love for your favorite station. You can also support us by adopting one of our shows or more as a buddy, in which case the money is taken from your debit or credit card on a monthly basis. You can do so by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBI.org. Now we go to the final segment of today's show. So, Narsa, I have to ask you this question. You know, at the time of independence for most African countries in the 1960s, independence, liberty, freedom, uhuru, was mostly negotiated in most of these countries. In other words, the political elite, the emerging political elite, young Africans who led the country to uhuru, negotiated with the former colonial powers. In the case of English-speaking countries, the British colonies, they went to Lancaster House in London to negotiate the kind of governments that were to follow the colonial era. And of course, I like pointing this out If you have to negotiate the terms of independence with the former colonial power in their capital, I very much doubt that the outcome is going to be good for the newly independent country. Can you imagine the United States, after throwing out the British, going to London to negotiate the terms of what was then to follow? Of course not. You want independence on your own terms. So we've never really had independence on our own terms, meaning we've not yet even had the time to explore what kind of political system is appropriate for African countries. Independence can't be just creating a model parliament to replicate what you have in London or Paris and then think this is going to embrace your people and get your people actively involved in the politics. So I've always thought we need to explore and ask the critical question, are the current types of political systems we have, are they the most appropriate for African countries? So I leave you with that question to ponder. What is your response?
I think you nailed it. You nailed it. You cannot ask someone to give you your freedom and your independence. And if you are a human being or a man, you just take it for that matter. So I think you gave a fantastic example of the United States and England or United Kingdom. You just said the United States because they are United, right? And we are Guinea, we are Uganda, we are Ghana. We're just pseudo countries. We are not. If the GDP of the city of New York is larger than the GDP of Guinea, the whole country, just the city, the five boroughs of New York. And you tell me that Guinea can have a bilateral meeting with the United States, where President Alpha Conde can sit down on the same ground as President Joe Biden. I think that's where our founding fathers had an exceptionally clear vision, right, that their predecessors missed. I think it would have been easier to have the United States of Africa to negotiate with the United States of America.
Absolutely.
And negotiate with China or Russia, right? And the European Union has shown us what that looks like, and they don't want us to unite, right? As long as we are Guinea, as long as we are Togo, we are Ivory Coast, we are Senegal, we are right. Uganda, we won't be able to achieve that properly. The second thing I want to say really quickly, it's yes. the Rwandan model, right? So I think there are two ways of fighting with your enemy. It's fighting with pride and dignity, and fighting strategically. I think our founding fathers, some of them fought with pride and dignity. Our former president Ahmed Sekou Touré fought with pride and dignity and said to heck France and General de Gaulle, and we have been isolated. You have been paying the price of that. He said, you are not giving us our freedom. You are taking it. And we paid the price of that, right? And in a horrible, horrible way by being isolated for about 20 years, right? Right. And in Rwanda, President Kagame has just changed French as a national language to English swiftly. He's not saying to hell France. He's just saying we are surrounded by English speaking countries and it makes more sense for us to integrate English into our curriculum. I think having that softer tone, because it's, to me, the end is what matters, right? So I think it's incumbent to us to think about the Rwandan models, which also answer some of the questions that you have. One of the questions that you have asked, whether democracy or the political system that we are having are right for us, right? So I think the Rwandan model can give us a lot to think about. There are some positive things that we can take out of it. There are some negative things that we can think to improve. But without unity, without understanding the language of your enemy, without understanding the language of the former colonizer, we are still and will be still colonized.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I would have liked for us to go into a deeper discussion on Rwanda, but we are completely out of time, unfortunately. We're going to have you back, absolutely. But quickly, give people your contact information. You spoke us about the, particularly the digital medical intervention. I think some listeners might want to perhaps even get involved with you. So give out any contact information, whether it's your email or a website, in the 30 seconds we have left.
Absolutely. So our website is www.clinic, clinic-o.org. clinic-o.org. You can find the work that we are doing there. You can get involved. You can learn more about how we are providing primary care services to 8 million people in Guinea and 100 million people in West Africa.
And thank you so much. I'm going to have you back to give us an update on how this program is going in a few months' time. Listeners, remember to go to blackstarnews.com as well. You can follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. Remain Pan-African and see you next week. Thank you to our guests.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Olympic gymnast Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, Ali Raisman, and Maggie Nichols will testify tomorrow at a U.S. Senate hearing, which will be about the FBI's failures in investigating U.S. gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar, who was sentenced for sexually abusing women and girls under his care. The committee's goal is to determine why the FBI's Indianapolis field office responded so slowly and so inadequately to the first accusations of Nassar's sexual misconduct. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal commented, quote, that the FBI's gross mishandling of the reports of Nassar's abuse led to more athletes suffering unimaginable pain. There must be accountability for this chilling failure to properly investigate and false statements potentially intended to cover up that failure. More than 150 women and girls came forward in court saying that he had sexually abused them over the past two decades. In a tweet earlier this year, Simone Biles commented on the situation, quote, "I am not afraid to tell my story anymore. I, too, am one of the many survivors that was sexually abused by Larry Nassar." Hurricane Nicholas, now a tropical storm, made landfall along the Texas coast early today. Powerful wind gusts and heavy rains came over Texas, sweeping its way across the Houston metropolitan area. By 1 p.m. today, Tropical Storm Nicholas was about 30 miles southeast of Houston. Its maximum sustained winds had eased up to 40 miles per hour, with higher gusts as it moved east-northeast at 7 miles per hour. The storm is now on a path towards Louisiana, where tens of thousands are still without power from Hurricane Ida. On Wednesday, Tropical Storm Nicholas will likely have arrived to Louisiana, with potentially 20 inches of rain in isolated storms. More than 500,000 homes and businesses were without power in southeast Texas today, including the Houston area as of late this morning, according to PowerOutage.us. California voters today are casting their ballots on whether to recall Governor Gavin Newsom in a special election that has pitted the state's majority Democrats against Republican supporters of former President Donald Trump. If a majority votes no on the recall question, Newsom will remain governor. If 50% plus one vote yes, then he would be ousted as governor and the candidate who receives the most vote on the second question would serve the remainder of Newsom's term until January 2023. Larry Elder is the top polling Republican among those vying to replace Newsom, and there are questions about how willing Elder will be to accept the results of today's vote if Newsom survives. Elder has already begun to support an emerging new narrative pushed by major Fox News personalities that claim Governor Gavin Newsom will only win the recall because of election fraud, despite the lack of any credible evidence. Polls in California are set to close at 8 p.m. Pacific time. Today, voters in Boston are heading to the polls in a historic preliminary election for the mayoral seat in the city. Recent polls showed that City Councilor Michelle Wu was leading in the field with a tight race for the second spot between Acting Mayor Kim Janey and City Councilors Andrea Campbell and Anissa Espisai George. This means that the next elected mayor of Boston will be a person of color, which would be a first for the city. This preliminary